You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
July 15th of 2010, Enbridge was asked to testify before Congress on their pipeline and their safety record, and they were quoted as saying that they can detect a leak almost instantaneously. This was, again, on July 15th, and then on July 26th or 25th, there was a series of issues in their Line 6B. So quickly, I'm going to go through this timeline. At 5:56 p.m., there were alarms going off in their control room, indicating that there was an issue in the line. A few minutes later, they went ahead and shut down the line and tried to figure out what the problems were, why there were alarms. And 9:26 p.m. that evening was the first of many 911 calls going into our local officials reporting the smell of oil and gas in the area. And these 911 calls continued throughout the night. The following day, early in the morning, Enbridge continued to try to restart the line, troubleshoot what was going on. They did something called mass balance analysis, where they tried to push product through the line or try to restart it, in other words. Again, 911 calls continued. Emergency officials were not able to locate the source because of the time of day. It was very dark. And around 11:11 on the next day, a local utility, Consumers Energy, located the spill or saw the spill and reported it to Enbridge. And later that day, Enbridge reported it to the National Response Center. And this was 18 hours after alarms indicated that there was an issue. Our local utility had to let them know that there was a spill. So there was around 800,000 to a million gallons of oil, crude oil, that spilled into a 5-acre area. The pipeline burst in a marshland or a wetland, and that became so heavily saturated that it leaked into a creek, Talmadge Creek, and this creek fed into the Kalamazoo River, and oil traveled around 40 miles of the Kalamazoo River before it was contained. Because emergency responders were focusing on containing the oil and trying to clean up what was going on, and the residents kind of became the back end of it, and they weren't informed that they probably should not be in their homes breathing the air, they should not be drinking their water. It was a matter of weeks before real notices went out indicating that people should be evacuating their homes, and a water ban was put in place. Many people did not even realize that we had a pipeline going through our backyard. The pipeline was close to 40 years old. It was built in the 60s. And, you know, as time passes, people forget or are not as aware of the issue. And so a lot of people were just in shock that this could have happened in our area. And I remember thinking, okay, I'm setting up plans to go down and help with the BP spill. My mom had just gotten back. She was encouraging me greatly to go do my part and help. And weeks later, we have our own spill to deal with. And so it was a complete shock that this could even happen in our area. And so who's in charge? Enbridge is in charge for the spill. They've taken responsibility. The EPA has stepped in because under the Clean Water Act, they are considered the agency that's going to oversee cleanup. And so that's what they did. They oversaw Enbridge's cleanup. And Enbridge had to submit a cleanup plan to the EPA and the Unified Command, which is made up of other federal agencies and state agencies, showing what they would do in order to make this situation correct. And that cleanup plan was rejected. And it wasn't until, I believe, mid-August that they accepted their cleanup plan and started moving forward quickly on how they were going to respond. In the days after the spill, I remember going on site and trying to locate certain areas of the river that I knew moved a lot faster, and I knew there needed to be containment booms, workers in those areas, and I found nobody. My coworkers and I were wandering the river. We literally went the whole length of the river and barely saw any boom or cleanup, and this was days after the spill. I didn't hear about the spill on NPR until around Tuesday or Wednesday, and the spill again happened on Sunday. There were heavy rains the days before, and so the river was at flood state and made everything move a lot faster, and it saturated a lot of wildlife habitat, wetlands. It's just pure oil. And we were driving on the highway on the way there, and you could smell it in your car. It was just, it took over the whole town, all the communities. So President Obama was briefed on the situation and said that he would be providing resources to help wherever needed. Our governor, Jennifer Granholm, was very frustrated by what she was seeing. She did not feel the response was adequate, was not moving quick enough. And Emmerich said that their efforts bordered on overkill. And Jennifer Granholm disagreed with that heavily. And she issued a state of emergency. And that allowed a lot of resources to come in to help with the cleanup, including money from federal funds, which will hopefully eventually be paid back. This is the first public meeting. It was very obvious that everybody was completely confused, frustrated. I was really, really hoping for a question and answer session, and every single public meeting I went to did not offer that. They got up, they explained what happened, and then if you wanted to talk to a volunteer with an agency off to the side, you could. Otherwise, you basically just listened to what they had to say and what updates they gave. There's little to no transparency, and it really, really frustrated every single person. I did not talk to a single person that was happy with the response in the first few weeks, especially considering that air quality and water quality were an issue. People's livelihoods were at stake, and many people were concerned just to be in their homes, period. This is a picture of Sorezco Dam. I wanted to tell a quick story about a woman that I met along this journey. She owns her property right above the dam, and then she lives right below the dam, so double whammy. She can't escape. Nobody ever came to tell her that she should evacuate. Nobody told her that she shouldn't be drinking the water. It was all hearsay. She went to public meetings, learned about it, relayed the message to neighbors that maybe weren't able to go. She has a couple disabled neighbors. But the killer here is that she's going through chemotherapy. She has cancer, and she's living in her home for days before she realizes that she's breathing benzene, which is a carcinogen, among other VOCs. And so she's just been so heavily impacted, and then her property above the dam, which is her business, was closed off because of boom and because of workers, and so they couldn't even open their business for months. She was testifying at a hearing that I attended because she couldn't get an answer from Enbridge about how to get a claim. You know, same story. Her business is closed. They're not making money. It's a very simple, cut and dry situation. And they said that they're not set up to deal with businesses at the time. And so it took her 3 visits to the community center, all of which people told her over and over again, they're not ready to help her. They don't have the system set up. And then she obtained a lawyer late September, so this is a month and a half or 2 months after the spill, and the lawyer was able to work it out. And so they stretch you so thin, they frustrate you so much to the point where you feel like your only option is to go through legal actions, and many people can't afford that. And so she, you know, I can't echo enough, it's really the same exact situation, just a different place, and it's just, it breaks my heart to hear that's going on. Because I know what she went through, and I know all the residents sitting right there next to her went through the same exact thing. This is the pipeline. It did restart. It restarted around a month after the burst happened. It was a little over a month. Our regulatory system disapproved the first restart plan, but shortly after that, they approved it, and the river was nowhere near clean, so this was frustrating for a lot of residents that, here we are dealing with this mess, and they're able to start up business and continue on like nothing happened. Now, this is a report released, so I'll just quickly mention that this came out a few weeks ago, and it discusses how diluted bitumen, which is a product that runs through most of the pipelines coming from Alberta, has a higher acidic contents than conventional crude. It's 15 to 20 times higher concentrations. This weakens and embrittles the pipelines faster than originally thought. And so, our state has a ton of pipelines that transport diluted bitumen through them in our state. They're older. We weren't accounting for this. And so I know it's just a matter of time before our Great Lakes, which are one of the biggest freshwater resources in the world, is going to have a situation similar to what we had in the Kalamazoo River. And in fact, I attended a oil spill conference last week, and their sole purpose is to prepare when an oil spill does hit the Great Lakes. We had a lot of worker rights and safety issues. You can see that these gentlemen are literally knee-deep in oil and have no protective gear on their face. They have little to no protective gear on their body. They have like a thin hazmat suit, and that's it. And this is something that we saw over and over again. We really had to fight to ensure that they were treating workers correctly. And these photos were not taken, a few days after the spill. Some of these photos were taken weeks after the spill. This is just not acceptable. This gentleman's cleaning out a skimmer, so there's oil that's being pushed into one area where the skimmer picks it up and pushes it onto a truck. And so it's really, really heavy amounts of oil and benzene where he's working, and he has no protective gear on. Our wetlands and shoreline were saturated very heavily, so wildlife took a huge, huge hit. The first visit, this is a muskrat that we came across. He was desperately trying to clean himself. He went in and out of the water several times, trying to clean off. Little did he know he was continuing to oil himself. You saw earlier in my slides, there was a picture of a sign that said, call this number. We called that number, and the woman told us, no, you have to call this new 800 number that Enbridge has set up. We called that 800 number. It went unanswered. Later in the week, we saw these geese. Same thing. We called the 800 number. Finally, we got through to somebody. They said that they're answering the calls on an as-need basis. It was Enbridge answering the phone call, and that they would get out there as soon as possible. We went back to the area later that evening, and there were still many geese that were saturated with oil. And we later would discover that a lot of reptiles, turtles, took the biggest hit. Residents were so frustrated by the fact that you could not get through to report wildlife that had been oiled that they started making these makeshift cleaning stations, and they were shut down as quickly as they opened because of liability. Enbridge, the EPA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services were all in consensus that it was too much of a risk. They didn't have experience handling oiled wildlife, and so people were just left to watch how this unfolded as Enbridge decided, or the EPA decided, there was nothing anybody could do. And I should also mention that the 800 number was the same number that you called if you had health issues, if you were concerned about your water, and it was Enbridge at the end of the line that you had to ask your questions to and get answers from. We had the opportunity to accompany U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services on a recovery effort of turtles. There were so many turtles and reptiles that were impacted in the matter of thousands, and many of them still remain at the facility because they weren't collected until after what would be considered their season to hibernate or burrow in, and so they have to be held throughout the winter months. This is a blue heron that they caught. And heron actually were also a very big hit because they had a lot of burns on their skin. Somehow geese, they're able to be cleaned and they're okay and they survived, but the heron had a lot of issues, according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. The oil impacted them a lot differently. This is a picture of an owl, plastic owl on a stick, and that's an impacted wetland, and that's how they're trying to keep wildlife out of that polluted area. A week or so after the spill, we came across this gentleman who was just starting up a solar power business. He had just gotten a grant from the federal government to install solar panels, and he happened to own a small part of his property that was running against the Kalamazoo River. He was on the back end towards Morrow Lake, and so he thought there was nothing wrong. He thought maybe there might be some sheen in the river outside of his property, but he had not heard from officials. He had not gotten a phone call saying anything was wrong up to his property. And so he's like, you know, I haven't walked back there yet. Why don't we walk together? This is his lane. And I stood there and I took the picture, and you can see the river in the background. And there was oil and in his wetland from where I stood all the way to the river. And he bent down and he put his finger in it. We all thought, we smelled the oil. But you smell the oil everywhere. But we thought, there's no way. It has to be mud. Our shoes were just coated in it because we didn't realize. It was just saturated everywhere. The whole wetland was just covered in oil. And I felt completely bad for him because he had no idea. Nobody had come to talk to him. It's one of those situations, again, the transparency is just non-existent. And everybody has well water along this river, and people just are not talking to them. They did put a water ban on well water, and the river is off limits to recreation and fishing, and it still remains off limits. Although the water ban on wells has been lifted, but it takes time for that kind of thing to show any impact, and so I have a feeling in the spring we might start to see some issues in that area. The current status of the river is that the EPA has said that Enbridge has lived up to what they considered their cleanup plan, and they're starting to transition so that the state is taking over future cleanup. Enbridge was quoted as saying that they're going to get every single drop of oil that has entered our wetlands and our rivers, and they've since gone back and said, you know, it's too intrusive to go in and rip out all the wetlands and all the vegetation. And so we're going to leave the oil in certain areas and monitor it over time and see how wildlife are impacted by it and see how it degrades, biodegrades in the environment. So in the spring, we'll have issues to deal with. They are addressing some things throughout the winter because people have had issue with them pulling boom and saying that they're going to stop for the winter months, and so they are addressing a few things, but cleanup for the most part has halted. I want to end by saying that, you know, our area is very accessible, it's very flat, it's farmland, and all the warning signs were on this pipeline. They had alarms going off. They tried restarting the line. The line was literally saying, don't restart me. And they still ignored it. The warnings were there, and they could not get to this pipeline. It leaked 18 hours before they were told that a spill had occurred. So I encourage you to think about how your landscape is in northern British Columbia and how this could translate to where you're at, and understand that, you know, technology is not all it's cracked up to be. Human error is always going to happen. So I'll leave you with that. And any questions afterwards, I'll try to answer.